through the Alaska Airlines studios.
This is Tom, Jake, and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Ross.
Welcome to Tom, Jake, and Stacy, a happy Wednesday edition. This hour of Tom, Jake, and Stacy, by the way, brought to you by Car Toys. We're going to try to reassure both ourselves and everybody out there who's listening today, because I think that maybe we're in a little bit of denial about the fact that the Seahawks don't have a pass rusher. Jadeveon Clowney, just not going to happen. So we're just like kind of putting this thing out of our minds. But there are answers on the team. There could be answers on the team. We can't make any guarantees today, Stacy, but it doesn't have to be like the one superstar guy, right? There could be answers to whatever Seahawks problems there are already on the roster, correct?
Yeah, certainly. We've had that happen before.
Yes, and sometimes it comes from maybe places that we don't expect. Guys like, you know, for every Ziggy Ansah, or you know what? I can't say for every one Ziggy Ansah, there's another good player on the team somewhere. But sometimes, if you think back to last year, a guy like Ziggy Ansah gets brought in here, and he's expected, because he's getting paid, and he's got a good reputation other than his health, he's expected to contribute. And what happens when he doesn't? Everybody's up in arms. But maybe there are other guys, like a Jacob Hollister, a Will Disley, guys like that who emerge, and they end up playing really well. They end up surprising you. So in looking at the roster right now, who might those guys be? Is it a Bruce Irvin? Is it a Benson Mayoa? Is it somebody like that? We're not saying you can depend on any of these guys, but you're likely, the numbers say you're likely to be pleasantly surprised by somebody. How about Bruce Irvin, Jake? What do we think about him?
Well, Bruce Irvin, I think for a couple of different reasons, is a guy that is someone that is easily overlooked. And I think, you know, Stacy, you know, as we were, you know, talking about the show, really articulated this well, is that you oftentimes overlook some of these guys. That Bruce Irvin, 32 years old, you know, are the Seahawks just bringing him back for a farewell tour, or are they actually bringing him back to be a major contributor? And there's a couple things about Bruce Irvin that I really like about him. And number one is he has been extremely consistent throughout his NFL career. He has always been a guy who has generated, I think at his lowest was 5.5 sacks in his career, his 9-year career so far. And so to me, that is extremely comforting, knowing that you're getting a player who's going to produce, who's going to be a factor in games. And then the other side of it, guys, is his leadership ability. You know, one of the biggest aspects about this team that I think really was failing was the defensive side of the ball. You could talk about schematics. You can talk about a lot of different areas. But the one area that really stood out to us as a show is the fact that they didn't have presence. There was no real presence to that defense. There was no attitude. There was no toughness, no edge. And you know who brings edge is Bruce Irvin. Bruce Irvin brings a ton of edge to any defense that he plays in. He brings a leadership quality, an air of confidence, a guy who's not going to back down from anybody. And he's been in this system before and knows what to expect. And that, to me, guys, is production as a player in his career and his leadership ability, his true toughness and grit and nastiness is something that this defense really needs a big boost in. I think Bruce can do that for sure.
Yeah, I mean, this defense had a lot of problems last year, and I'm not saying that they've found the answer yet. I don't think they have, if I'm being honest, and I don't think that you guys think they have either, but I think that Bruce Irvin's interview was very refreshing. He's very excited to be back. But one thing that stood out was him making a joke about being the oldest guy in the room. And he's not really, but he's close. Turning 32 in any NFL locker room, you're quite a bit older than the average age of a guy, which is probably around 25 or so for Seattle. But I think that once guys hit 30, and I see it all the time on comments for things whenever people are signed, once guys hit 30, they're seen as like essentially over the hill, and it's a sentimental signing, or it's a signing based on someone's past success, and you can't expect them to change. I think that it is fair to have that assumption, and I'm not going to knock anyone for having it, right? Your body starts to wear down when you get older. In real life, 30's young. In football years, you've been taking quite a beating for presumably 8, 9, maybe 10 years. But I think that it makes me wonder whether Bruce Irvin might be one of those guys that we're collectively overlooking, that we're thinking, well, he was in this system and this is the sentimental signing by Pete Carroll and he's coming back in to finish his career. But what if he's coming back in and he can actually be a force? I mean, all you really need is to contribute a few sacks, right? They need someone to come in and help them and be a star. But if they don't have that guy, then at least come in and help chip into that rotation.
Well, and the other aspect about it too, guys, is that Bruce Irvin is not 32 years old coming off his worst production in his career. He's actually coming off his best season as a pro in terms of generating sacks. He had 8.5 sacks, which was a career high for him. And couple that with hearing cut number one, Bruce Irvin talking about how excited he is to get back and actually how last year it really hit him how badly he wanted to be back, so much so that he started texting guys on the team after he was watching their games.
Seattle was the primary place when we played them. After we played, was it week 14 or something? I was like, damn, man, I wish I was with those guys. After the Philly game, actually, I sent Bobby a text message while he was on the plane. I was like, man, I wish I was on that plane with y'all. You know, I just wanted to come back, man. I've never... Yeah, you know, like I said, I can't complain about anywhere I've been, but, you know, nothing has been like Seattle from how they travel to how we practice, how they take care of their older players, from the cafeteria, from fertility being on the lake, from it's just everything, man. It's just great, eh? And, you know, it's just they run it right up there, man. I'm just happy to be back.
When you have a player that has a full understanding like that, to me, It excites me to no end, because not only is he a good player, not only was he a first-round pick by the Seahawks, but he was around during the most successful time, right? And so he knows and knows what that tangibly looks like and what that expectation is in that culture. And so, Tom, I don't know how you feel, but it really excites me to have that presence back.
Yeah, I mean, to Stacey, just going back to Stacey's point real quick, though, about certain guys that end up emerging, like a Will Dissly or a Jacob Hollister or somebody like that, like those guys are totally off the radar. And then they hit, and it's like, wow, these guys become essential parts of the team. They end up going from nothing unnoticed to being essential parts of the team. Bruce Irvin is kind of in an in-between area because he's being brought back at an older age. And I think when he was first signed here, he was looked at as being kind of like he's padding or he's insurance to whatever their big move is going to be. And now they haven't made the big move.
True.
And it looks like Bruce Irvin is their biggest move. So now I'm looking at him like, oh, okay, well, not only do I hope he's kind of, you know, that he ends up being a diamond in the rough, I'm kind of depending on it. I mean, I'm looking at some of the other guys like Benson Mayoa, and some of the guys that are already here, LJ Collier, guys like that, who you expect very little of to end up blossoming into something. Maybe even a Rasheem Green, somebody like that, who we've been counting on for years and years now. Like, if I'm a fan right now who's miffed because Clowney isn't here and because they didn't make the big pass rush signing, I'm looking at those guys hoping that either each one of them improves for this year or one of them ends up just really having a standout season. That's how I'm looking at it.
I mean, totally. They don't have to be essential players. Like, I wouldn't say Jacob Hollister is an essential part of this team. He outperformed expectations. I mean, essential part of the team is a guy that is out there the majority of snaps, right? He's like a Tyler Lockett. And that's not a knock on Jacob Hollister. It's just to say that, like, he made himself, he made a statement with his play in 2019 that people weren't expecting from him. He had a great year. And one that he should be proud of. I think that that's kind of what I'm looking at with Bruce Irvin. It's not he's going to come in and be an essential core guy. It's are there – I think it's important to recognize that after free agency, after the draft, we rarely go back and say what were guys we were not talking about. What were guys we were not paying attention to? We were not looking at Will Disley as a pass-catching tight end. His first two games blew me away. We were not looking at Jacob Hollister as eventually your number one tight end. Yes, part of that was because of injury, but he also played well. We were not looking at Quandre Diggs. I mean, I know Jake was a big fan of him, but we were not looking at Quandre Diggs as a guy that was quickly going to become maybe the best player in your secondary. Right? We weren't looking at Ugo Amadi after the draft. Everyone was focusing on DK Metcalf, yet Ugo Amadi came in and played very well on special teams. Jake was calling for him to be at nickel corner all year. Pete Carroll said he wished he would have put them out there sooner. So there are guys that we overlook. And so the point is to look back and say, hey, before we get to that point at the start of the season, who might some of these guys be?
Yeah, let me give you four guys here real quick that – and, you know, two of them are going to be names that you're going to say, well, I don't know if you can throw that out there saying that we are not going to talk about these guys. They're going to be part of the conversation. But what is the expectation for them coming in? For me, I look at number one, a guy who may outperform everything that we were talking about is Brandon Schell, the tackle that they assigned from the New York Jets. Everybody, including myself, has not been overly thrilled about what they are, signed bringing in to replace Jermaine Nifedi. But if that player could step up, if Brandon Schell could step up at the right tackle position and not give as many penalties and not be a liability out there, I think that that would be a big boost for them and one that should be talked about as a surprise signing. Chance Warmack, a former first-round pick, a guy who in his career has played well. He took a year off because injuries started mounting on him, and maybe that's a guy that could come in and fill in at the right guard position in a well fashion. He's only 28 years old, guys, which is surprising. And then two rookies, Daryl Taylor and Jordan Brooks. To me, if those two guys can come in and outperform expectations, I think that you're talking about a group that, at least defensively, that can really improve significantly in a short bit, and more so Jordan Brooks. I think more people are questioning whether he's actually going to come in and be the day one starter, because obviously you have KJ Wright. But Jordan Brooks, to me, I think he could exceed expectations pretty easily his rookie season.
If both of those guys exceed expectations, I think you're going to have a real good situation on defense. I'd be happy with just one. And then maybe Alton Robinson becomes a second-year guy or something like that. Or who'd you say? Brooks and Taylor? Yeah. If one of those two guys blossoms this year, I'd be pretty darn happy with that. We'll come back to this a little bit later. We'll ask Mike Salk about it. We're also going to talk with Colin Cowherd coming up today at 1, my old mentor. And then we're going to speak with Shannon Dreyer at 2, talk a little bit of Mariners baseball, Felix Week, etc. Right now, I got three questions.
It's time for three questions.
Can't wait for it.
Every day at 12 after 12, Tom Wassel's burning questions for Jake Heaps and Stacey Rost.
Enough with the "we got to protect the kids" nonsense.
We heard that soundbite yesterday from Pete Carroll where he confessed that sometimes he gets overly hopeful on certain draft picks. And, you know, that makes sense. But is he really the only coach that does that? I mean, doesn't every GM or coach who misses on a prospect get overly hopeful? What do you think, Jake?
Yeah, of course. Of course they do. That's why they missed. That's why they made the selection in the first place, because they were excited about the potential of that player. I think what Pete Carroll, what he was saying more so than anything else, is he may go to so far to the extreme, Tom, that he may just see the strength of one player and just say, look, I don't care what the weakness is whatsoever. I don't even want to acknowledge what those weaknesses are, because I feel like those weaknesses are things that we can coach up. Some organizations, some teams do that as well, but maybe he goes to the extreme on that side. When he finds one unique attribute, he overlooks the rest of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to say that really any head coach is going to look at those guys, and the reason that they take them is because they're hopeful they'll work out. I think that Pete Carroll got a bit of a knock for this after the fact, because the Seahawks have, in the face of some red flags, taken guys. Those guys haven't worked out. And I think people see Pete Carroll as a player's coach to a fault, where he'll give guys second, third, fourth, fifth chances. I think sometimes that's over-exaggerated. I think that Pete Carroll and John Schneider will sever ties with guys if they feel like they're toxic to their program. But if you're not toxic in their mind to the program, I think they'll take a shot.
Question two.
Number two.
All right, coming off The Last Dance, the documentary we've all been watching for the last couple of weeks, if you're a guy like Horace Grant, Scottie Pippen, maybe Brian Russell or Clyde Drexler, are you mad that you were portrayed somewhat negatively in this thing, or are you happy that your name is back in the news, Jake?
I don't know. I think it would be kind of a torn feeling, because it would be awesome to be able to have your legacy, you know, re-looked at, and to be able to walk down memory lane. And it wasn't all bad, right? I mean, Scottie Pippen, there's going to be a lot of negative things that were said about him, but there was also positives. I mean, people got to relive and see that nasty dunk he had over Patrick Ewing. People got to relive and see exactly how good of a player he actually was. And yeah, there were some questionable things that he did along the way. So if I'm Scottie Pippen, I think that I would look at it as more of a good thing than a bad thing. But Horace Grant, I mean, he was a great player. He was a great player with the Bulls. He was a great player with the Orlando Magic. And more so than anything that came out from his story was that he was a snitch. He was, you know, leaking stories to, you know, a reporter, and it ended up getting written in a book, right? Like, that, to me, that's something that I wouldn't want out there. But if I'm a guy like Charles Barkley, right? Charles Barkley, you got a chance to see him skinny, looking good, MVP of the league, right? Like, you know, there's some positive aspects to it. But I could definitely see why a Byron Russell or Clyde Drexler, Horace Grant, wouldn't want or would be not happy about how they were portrayed.
Yeah, if I'm in the documentary without a chance to respond in a negative light, then I'm really upset. But a couple of these guys got in. I mean, Scottie Pippen was obviously a featured person there. But, like, Horace Grant, like, these guys got a chance to go on and be interviewed for it. So,
yeah, good point.
So, I mean, that is at least fair. What I will say is I don't think Scottie Pippen should be included in this list. This documentary made me like him more. I thought it, I mean, yes, it showed moments, but the negative things were stuff all of us already knew. Like him taking himself out or whatever. Yeah. Like, it's, I don't know. I was fine with the way he was portrayed. It's obviously not up to me, but if anything, I became more of a fan.
I actually found myself sympathizing with Scottie a little bit too. I thought that just based on things that I had read and heard, you know, people criticizing Scottie for ducking out on the team and, you know, would he or would he not, you know, continue to or want to be there for the rest of the run, that sort of thing. But yeah, I thought that I like Scottie too. I like the way that I ended up sympathizing him or with him. Question three.
Number three.
Okay, we're going to have Colin Cowherd on at 1 o'clock, as I said. This is a bite from his show, talking about what Pete Carroll would not have been had it not been for Russell Wilson. Cut three.
Pete Carroll had a losing record in Seattle. If Russell Wilson isn't drafted, Pete's not in the NFL, not in Seattle. He was getting one more year. They were paying him too much. Pete's career, NCAA baggage at USC, NFL, he'd already been fired twice, two losing seasons. If he didn't draft Russell Wilson, has Matt Flynn, he has a third losing season, he's done. He's now a legend.
He's done. I just love the way he says that. Okay, so here's the bottom line. No NFL coach is going to succeed without a franchise quarterback or something close to it.
Okay? Exactly.
So, right, Pete Carroll would be, had Russell Wilson not been drafted here, Pete Carroll would have joined tons and tons of other head coaches who didn't make it. Now, all those other things that Colin said, about him are true leading up to his career here. Yeah, he had a losing record here in Seattle until Russell got here, but he'd only been here for 2 years. I mean, would Matt Flynn have really turned into a complete bust? I don't know. Would they have given him another year? Might they have drafted somebody else? Maybe. Maybe. But I think we're all grateful that Russell's here, certainly, Jake.
Yeah, there's no question that we're grateful that Russell's here. You know, the other argument is that, okay, well, yeah, Russell was a huge part of this and all of that, but the defense is what carried the team. The running back, right? Marshawn Lynch, the Legion of Boom, that, you know, those were bigger factors than Russell Wilson at that point in time. And my argument back to that would be, think about some of the crazy heroics, crazy plays that Russell Wilson had to make in 2012, 2013, 2014 to give them opportunities to A, win games or advance in the playoffs. And,
yes.
And so, yes, it is the ultimate team game, but I do agree with Colin here in the sense that there were special aspects about Russell Wilson that helped make this team successful and help launch them to new heights, especially in 2012. After you had just experienced those 7-9 back-to-back 7-9 seasons, and under Matt Flynn, maybe they get above 500, maybe they're a 10-win team, but they definitely do not see anywhere near the success that they had seen if Russell Wilson's not your quarterback.
I just don't buy into the argument that Pete Carroll's a bad coach that lucked into a great quarterback. Do I think that having a great quarterback, especially a quarterback as great as Russell Wilson is, keeps you above 500 every year? Absolutely. I think he's not just your safety net. He's a big part of your success. Yeah, you'd be an idiot not to see that. But I think you're also simplifying the player-coach relationship by assuming that Russell is the sole person carrying this team and that there aren't not just important contributors on the roster amongst the other players, but that Pete Carroll doesn't have an important role to play there with coaching. I don't know. I think it's just an argument that I get really tired of.
Well, I don't think that Colin is saying that Pete's a bad coach.
I don't think he is, but it's an argument that stems from. There is an argument that exists that I think Colin is leaning on with this, that Russell Wilson is the key to Seattle's success. It is him. Pete Carroll would be saying Pete Carroll would be out of a job without Russell Wilson implies that Pete Carroll couldn't do enough. And I think that you're fair in saying, look, there are a lot of head coaches that would be out of a job without a franchise quarterback. But I think it puts a lot of weight on Russell Wilson without accounting for the fact that being an NFL head coach is difficult.
It's extremely difficult. And Pete gets credit for the team that he built around Russell, or the team he built before Russell Wilson, right? All the guys who are on defense here. But, I mean, without Russell, say that same team had gone forward with Matt Flynn. Are they going to the Super Bowl? Are they even making the playoffs?
Why is it not a good coaching decision to decide to ditch Matt Flynn, a free agent? You're paying more that you just signed.
Well, it is, but
that's
it's
coaching.
Also
but he only ditched him because Russell was here, right?
Yeah, but it's coaching deciding to move on from that guy.
You're absolutely right. But just as you had mentioned, or as Colin points out, that Pete Carroll was heading in on his third year in which he was going to be very much on the hot seat. 2012 was
a
year where he had to very much prove what he was doing. So, yes, he was building other aspects of the team. Him and John Schneider were. You insert Russell Wilson and boom, plug and play, and here we go. So I think that you can look at it in a bunch of different ways. I agree, Stacey. But ultimately, I do think that, you know, Russell Wilson was the major catalyst to make this, you know, take off and go to the heights it did.
All right, let's ask Mike Salk about this next. We'll play the Colin cut for him. Try not to stump him with difficult questions today. He's next, 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Tom, Jake, and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacey Rost.
Welcome back into Tom, Jake, and Stacey. We'll have Mike Salk on the phone here in just a second. All right, and now we'll welcome him in. Mike, how's it going, buddy? How are we doing today?
I had a little phone echo. My bad.
Oh, that's okay. You know, it's really interesting to me that with all the technological advances that we've made over like the last 40 or 50 years, the quality of telephone signals are basically what they were in like the 1940s. I'll never understand that.
Yeah, I'm like my grandfather whenever I get on the phone. I'm like, hey, can you guys hear me? I'm just talking on the phone here. Like my grandfather thinks he had to call Seattle by yelling to Seattle.
Right, exactly. Like the further away you are, the louder you have to talk. Oh, man.
Unbelievable.
Hey, Mike, we're gonna have Colin Cowherd on later at 1 o'clock, and he had a couple of different thoughts. One about Dak Prescott, but also one about, you know, he's always in praise of Russell Wilson. We know that Colin's a big fan of Russell, but there's this idea of, you know, the head coach is only going to be as successful as his quarterback, you know, or however far his quarterback can carry him. Let's take a listen to this bite here real quick. Curtis, go ahead and roll that.
Pete Carroll had a losing record in Seattle. If Russell Wilson isn't drafted, Pete's not in the NFL, not in Seattle. He was getting one more year. They were paying him too much. Pete's career, NCAA baggage at USC, NFL, he'd already been fired twice, two losing seasons. If he didn't draft Russell Wilson, has Matt Flynn, he has a third losing season, he's done. He's now a legend.
Let's say for a second that happened, Mike, that Pete ended up having another losing season, ends up getting fired. But he still put together a pretty darn good defense there. Is it possible that a coach can get fired and still be a good coach?
Well, sure. I mean, generally they get fired by GMs and owners that aren't patient enough to wait for them to come around. I mean, Bill Belichick got fired in Cleveland. I mean, you know, he was turned out to be a pretty good coach. So, yeah, I think all that is true. I'll disagree with Colin. I don't think Pete Carroll was getting fired after another year, and I think that kind of doesn't really tell the whole story. Yeah, he had a losing record, but made the playoffs one year with a 7-9 record, and by the way, ended up, you know, winning a game and very nearly making the NFC Championship game that year. I mean, if Jordan Babineau makes the pick that hits him in the hands, they probably beat Chicago and they're in the NFC Championship game. The next year, he has a pretty decent season with Tavares Jackson. The team's getting better. The defense is getting better. And, you know, would they have been as good with Matt Flynn or anybody else quarterback? No, of course not. Russell Wilson's a superstar. Would they have been good in 2012 and 13 with somebody other than Russ? Yeah, they still would have been good. They still would have been above 500, I believe. And I'll just disagree with Colin's characterization of where the Seahawks were going. Russell was the thing that put them over the top and made them a championship team. But they were going to be a decent team as long as they had a decent quarterback. You know, whenever we talk about, and we got to see it with Peyton Manning, right? When Peyton Manning got hurt in Indianapolis, the problem was they didn't replace Peyton Manning with a serviceable quarterback. They replaced Peyton Manning with the dregs of the NFL because they'd never taken care of that position. You know, you can't just compare where you'd be without a great quarterback and just throw in some bum. You have to wonder where they would have been if the Seahawks had tried to, you know, find quarterbacks in other places. That's part of the conversation.
Salk, why do we perpetually do this? Why do we go down this conversation where we have to the credit game, right? We just in circles. Russell Wilson, it wasn't him. It was the defense. It's not Pete Carroll. It's Russell Wilson. Pete Carroll is the, you know, is the man who, you know, put this whole thing together. John Schneider doesn't really have much say in it. How could we keep doing this to ourselves? Why can't we just appreciate the entire puzzle that was put together to create something great?
That's a good question, and I've thought about that over the years. Like, why do we all play this game? And I think the answer is because you're trying to win next year. It's because when the season ends and you're a champion, guess what? You're just waking up the next day, preparing for the next year and trying to repeat. You have to play the credit game because you have to try to figure out what were the pieces that I need to use moving forward and which ones can I let fall by the wayside because of inflation, because everybody wants to get paid, because in the NFL there's a salary cap, et cetera. You've got to make tough choices and you've got to determine who gets the power, who gets to make the decisions, who gets to stick around, who gets the big contract, and who do you let go because you just can't keep everybody. So you have to end up having these questions about credit, not just in the past, but in the future, right? Was it the Legion of Boom or was it Russell Wilson? Was it the pass rusher? Was it the cornerbacks? You've got to decide which guys are most important to your future.
And that's what strikes me about, you know, this conversation that gets brought up in, you know, 2018. Did, you know, the Seahawks really go and explore that road of trading him and you know, looking to potentially move on? You know, you bring up the contract negotiations. You don't know where that's going to lead. But also there could have been that side of the organization that said, hey, we put this whole thing together. We think we can do it again. We think John Schneider and Pete Carroll are the answer to this.
Yeah, I don't buy that, though. I don't think that's the case. And the reason we know that is because they signed Russell Wilson to the gigantic deal that they ended up signing him to. I don't think that was the case. And you know, I know Colin, you guys are going to talk to him. You can ask him, but I know Colin has sort of said, been on the Seahawks were crazy to even think about this. I think if Colin were to really think about it and were pressed on it, he would say, yeah, if I were in John Schneider's shoes, I absolutely would have explored a trade because I don't know whether or not I'm going to be able to sign this guy. I don't know whether his baseball agent is going to make him go to New York. Colin was part of that. Wasn't it Colin who was saying he was interested in going to New York City to play with the Giants?
Yes.
I mean, Colin, of all people. Yeah. I mean, he if anybody should think that way, if they're John Schneider, it would be Colin. So I don't think that's the case, Jake. I really don't. I don't think that they thought they could do it another way. I think they just were legitimately unsure of how Mark Rogers, the wild card in the whole thing, was going to play this. And so they needed to protect themselves against that.
Do you think there's a different kind of pressure on Pete Carroll then? Because obviously he's out of a hot seat given their success over the last several seasons with Russell Wilson. But, I mean, doesn't that bar move to a divisional playoff isn't enough? And a conference championship isn't enough? I mean, where's the bar right now? Where's that hot seat?
For who? For Pete?
For Pete.
I don't think there's much of a hot seat or a bar for Pete. I think he is the thing this whole thing revolves around. Do I think that there's a hotter seat for John? Yeah, I do. I think when you start, when we were talking to Daniel Jeremiah about this yesterday on the podcast, it was a really good, and I love Daniel Jeremiah. He's awesome. You can find him at brockandsalkpodcast.com. I mean, you know, he's saying you should have one impact player per draft. Well, since 2012, the Seahawks have, depending on how you look at it, 2 to 4 impact players they've drafted. I'll give you Lockett, I'll give you Clark, and then maybe Jaron Reed and maybe DK Metcalf. We'll see where it goes. That's not good enough. DJ says you're supposed to come away from each draft with 3 starters. Have the Seahawks come away with each of those drafts with 3 starters, solid starters that are contributing? No. You got a drafting problem here over the last 7 years. And so, no, I don't think Pete's under much of a hot seat at all. But if this team isn't an NFC championship kind of contender this year, yeah, I'd be a little bit more worried about John than I would be about Pete.
Thanks for joining us, Mikey. We appreciate it.
All right. Say hi to Colin. Hope he doesn't call you a creep.
We've gotten past that. You know what's interesting about coming away with 3 starters per draft? If you came away with 3 bona fide starters, I would grade that draft an A. Like, I know what Jeremiah
Absolutely.
Is saying, like, that's what you aim for, but, like, if you came away with 3 starters every single year, that to me is near perfection.
Yeah, it is near perfection. It is near perfection, but also, when you talk about some of the best teams across the league, they're hitting that near perfection more often than not. And I think the amount of misses to, you know, have that number that Daniel Jeremiah threw out there in Seattle is a little bit alarming. And I will give some credence to that for sure.
All right, coming up next, LeBron James is now getting in on the documentary business, and he's got one that everybody's going to want to see. We'll talk about it next. 710 ESPN Seattle.
Wassel, what a creep.
You're listening to Tom, Jake, and Stacy.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Rost.
Okay, try to follow me on this because there's 2 important parts to this story, and it kind of gets a little confusing. LeBron James's film company has decided to make a documentary about the Astros sign-stealing scandal. The working title, by the way, is Sign Language. It's a good title.
Is it?
Yeah, you don't like it? Oh, man, I love it.
I think you could do better than that. nothing against sign language. Obviously, a great language, but it's just too obvious.
Yeah. Okay, so LeBron James's film company is also connected to Clutch Sports Group, which is a sports agency. Now, one of their clients is Alex Bregman of the Houston Astros, you know, MVP candidate, etc. And one of the guys who was caught up in this sign-stealing scandal. So, because this Clutch Sports Group is helping to fund LeBron James's film company in this documentary, Alex Bregman's none too pleased about that, and he has now left that agency. I can't really say that I blame him. I mean, in some ways, you get what's coming to you, like, deal with it. But if he wants to go somewhere else, that's his right. Now, the second part of it is just that this documentary is being made. It seems to me right now that because we don't have a ton of live sports and we'll see what we end up getting, we as a sports culture have just a thirst, an appetite for sports documentaries. And believe me, as much as I was glued to The Last Dance, I will definitely be glued to this one because I'll be really interested to see what they end up unearthing that we don't already know. I mean, there are unanswered questions like we know that it started with Alex Cora, but what was the process? Who went to who? Who suggested, hey, we need to do this? Did anybody resist? You know, I want to be taken through a blow-by-blow account with those involved, or as many people as involved as they can get who will speak on the record as to what the heck happened here. I am in 100% on this. Stacey?
Yes, and it's Curtis, you're going to like this one. The production company that released Fire Festival's documentary, Fire Fraud, are the investigative team behind this documentary.
Oh, I'm all
so
in.
So if you were all about watching documentaries about Fire Festival, which was just, I can't even put into words
they
the
could
hot
stand
mess
to do,
that was.
They could stand to do an entire Last Dance on Fire Festival.
Absolutely, and I would watch it 10 times over. But they uncovered quite a bit of stuff, and it was so well-researched and well-presented. So knowing that, having watched that documentary, this is going to be an incredibly, in my opinion, like unforgiving look at this. I mean, they didn't hold back in that Firefest documentary.
It'll be really interesting to see how it all comes together and who's going to talk, right? Like, we hear about the culture of baseball, and it really is kind of like snitches get stitches. Like, you don't snitch on each other. You don't snitch on your family. You know, what happens in the clubhouse stays in the clubhouse. And to see who is going to stand up and talk and really get into some of those details, Tom, that you're really looking for and for that investigative team to find out, that's what I'm really going to be curious about. Because if they can't deliver on the goods of that, then this documentary will just be a flop if they're just recapping everything that we already know. They have to get down to what happened here. I think that part I would be all for and glued to as well. And how quickly can they get this done?
Well, here's the thing. I want to go back to what you said right there. Like, who's willing to speak right now? I mean, this just happened. I mean, the sign stealing happened 3 years ago, or it started then, and then it came up to the present. But the story only came out a couple of months ago. So the question for the filmmakers is, are they making a mistake by doing this documentary too soon? Because if I'm an Astro, or I'm somebody who's involved in this scandal, I don't really want to talk right now. Like, the Last Dance, that happened 20 years ago and beyond. A lot of people who are willing to talk, like, Scottie Pippen can be accused of this or that and sit there with a smile because it happened 25 years ago. It's like, whatever. This stuff just happened. So if the documentary filmmakers are unable to get anybody of note to talk on the record about this because it just happened, that could be a mistake. I mean, look, everybody wants to be the first one to make this documentary, I'm sure. But sometimes the best thing to do is to wait a few years. And
yeah,
when people are more willing to speak, I think.
I don't disagree with you. I mean, the documentary, the only thing I could find about a release date was that more was coming out later this year. So whether it's in like late summer or whatever, I don't know if that's when it would premiere or that's when you would just start finding out more about it. But this isn't something that's coming up right away. But one thing I'll say is this kind of feels like there were no answers and there was no resolution for so many baseball fans in light of this scandal. And because of that, there's this like unquenchable thirst that people have for more news about it. And I think that drives a documentary like this to come out much sooner than would The Last Dance, where it was like, okay, beginning, middle, end, like, wow, what a franchise. This was, this is more of people being like, wait, that's it? That's all we got? And so they want more.
Absolutely. I mean, you guys, this is when one of the more passionate things that we've talked about up to this point is the fact that the Astros have literally received almost nothing of a punishment to the actual people that were involved in this scandal. Mm-hmm. That's the most amazing part to me. But thinking about it in terms of who's willing to talk, I think back to when this first came out, and after probably about like a couple weeks, you know, there's Tom Wassel and Mike Salk saying, all right, enough. I've heard enough from all these different players who are just piling on at this point because it's okay to come out and talk about it now. They didn't want to come out and talk about it before and be the first ones to talk, but now that this is out in the open, now everybody just wants to have their two cents in. So if you get it from that standpoint, you might have a lot of players that want to just pile on to this situation. You know, maybe you're an Astros player, maybe you're a Dodgers player, someone on the outside, but this is your opportunity to kind of have your self-righteous, you know, conversation about the game and the integrity of it, yet you were not willing to be the first to come out with that statement. So there might actually be more people willing to talk about it than we might think.
Mm-hmm. You know, there is one other tentacle to this story. I don't know how involved LeBron is going to be. Like, it's his film company. He either has full ownership or part ownership or whatever. But I wonder how the fraternity of athletes will look at him for exposing other athletes.
There were a lot of players talking after this scandal across different sports. I think that LeBron is in the majority with this one of athletes.
Yeah, I would say LeBron, I don't think will have an active role. If you know anything about LeBron and how he operates, he's got his hand in a lot of things, but he is more, I think what he's done a great job of with his empire so far is he's done a great job of hiring the right people to run his production company, to run his program, you know, all these different things that he's invested in. So I would anticipate that maybe he's funding it, but he's not a part of the daily, you know, production of it all.
All right, I want to get Colin Cowherd's thoughts on this. He's a big LeBron fan, obviously. And also, was it a good idea for John Schneider to explore other options than Russell Wilson? We'll do that next. 710 ESPN Seattle.